Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to introduce to you today the chairman of the Missouri Republican Party, who will be one of the two moderators, and he's going to introduce his counterpart this morning. So let's welcome Chairman David Cole.
Thank you, Lloyd. First of all, I would like to welcome you to Kansas City, to our Lincoln Day. It's been a successful weekend so far. We're certainly looking forward to the rest of the weekend. And I want to thank you and welcome you to our Senate candidate forum. I, along with my good friend, Congresswoman Joanne Emerson, she's from Southeast Missouri. She's going to be joining me as a moderator this morning. Congresswoman Emerson is from Missouri's 8th District. She is the first female Republican elected to Congress from Missouri. She represents, as I said, the 8th, which is in southeast and south central Missouri, and she serves on the powerful House Appropriations Committee. So again, thank you, Joanne, for taking time to be with us today. I'd like to take a moment to go over sort of the ground rules and how we're going to conduct ourselves in this forum this morning. The order on stage was drawn previously determined by a random drawing. Each candidate is going to be allowed 3 minutes for opening remarks before we move on to the questions. During this portion of the forum, each candidate will have 2 minutes to answer each question, and there will be no rebuttals. In the interest of time, that way we can get as many questions in as we possibly can. The order of the questions will rotate. At the conclusion of our question format, each candidate will have 3 minutes for closing remarks. Our timekeeper here in the front is sitting front and center. He will have show you when you have 30 seconds remaining. He will hold up a yellow card. At 10 seconds, he will hold up a red card. A bell will sound when time expires. We have several questions that have already been submitted by you in the audience. If you've not done so, please write down your question, hold it up. There will be people coming around picking those up and bringing them forward. Hopefully, we'll be able to get to as many questions as we possibly can. To ensure that we can do that, we would ask that you limit your applause and hold that until the end. That way, we can just speed up the process. So hopefully, we can get to as many questions as we can. Anyone who is disruptive, we will ask to leave. Now, I would like to introduce the candidates that we have with us on stage. We have businessman John Bruner. Congressman Todd Akin. Former State Treasurer Sarah Steelman. As I said, the order in which we're going to begin was drawn by lot earlier. We will begin with candidate opening statements. We will begin, Congressman Akin.
Well, thank you. It's a treat to join you. I'm Congressman Todd Akin, rated as the most conservative congressman in the state. And following engineering school, I did a commitment to the United States Army in the combat engineering. After that, I worked for IBM. I sold computers to all kinds of different manufacturing and distribution accounts, and then went on to work at Laclede Steel, where I was supervising over 2,000 people in the maintenance in 7 mills. About that time, I got the feeling that America was on the wrong track, and I decided to get into the political arena, even though I was very comfortable in business. Now, today, we've come to a point where, because of Ronald Reagan, everybody who gets into politics says that they're a Reagan conservative. So, you know, who do you know, and how do you know who to trust? And I would suggest to you that I've been in the arena. I've been tested under fire, and I fought on principle and not on politics, hence the conservative rating. I've taken the lead in pro-life, on traditional marriage, defending marriage between one man and one woman, even in the military, and limiting taxes. I actually wrote the section in the Missouri Constitution that says that you can't have a major tax increase in Missouri unless you have a public vote. I have also the same Reagan inclination toward a strong defense. I have 3 sons graduated from the Naval Academy. All 3 went into the United States Marine Corps. What can an Army guy do with a new generation? And being a straight-shooting veteran conservative, I also have the bruises and scars to prove that. The very first bill I ran into in Congress was No Child Left Behind. That was President Bush's first bill. I voted no. Why? because I don't really think the federal government constitutionally should be involved in education. And second of all, I think education is a local kind of thing. I also voted no on TARP. That was a high-profile vote. You're going to bail out, you're going to buy Goldman Sachs at double book value, or you really have $700 billion to spend on this. I believed no, and I voted no on TARP. More recently, we wanted to extend Obama's credit card with a debt ceiling vote. Many people that were Republicans, called themselves conservatives, voted for it. I said no. And those and many other votes, I've got the scars to show that I'm tested under fire and a principled, straight-shooting conservative. And I believe that a proven record is better than a promise. Now, moving forward, where do we need to be going? Well, let's take a simple look. We've got to take America back. You know that. I don't have to tell you we've got trouble. And one of the things the Senate does is appoint judges. Why don't we pick judges that defend the Constitution instead of try to rewrite it? You know, we also have to absolutely do what we do in Missouri. That is, cap and balance the Constitution, same way we do in Missouri. I see my time's up. Look forward to chatting with you in a minute.
Our next speaker with our opening statement is former Treasurer Sarah Steelman.
Well, it's great to be here today and among friends and family, if you will, the Republican family. And sometimes we disagree in families, just like in my family. My boys fight like cats and dogs, but then they make up and they love each other. And actually, I actually disagree with my husband sometimes, and we fight about things a bit, then we go on and talk about it. So I want to have a frank discussion with you all today about the Republican Party. And I think it's time that we recognize the role that the Republican Party is going to play in saving our great republic. And to be candid with you, it's not enough. It's not enough just to elect Republicans. We have to elect Republicans who are willing to fight for freedom, because there can never, ever, ever be any compromise on freedom. Now, 4 years ago, I ran for governor, and I came out against ethanol, and it made some people mad in the party, you know, frankly. But why did I do that? The reason I did that is because if we can have a government that mandates what kind of fuel you can put in your car, then we can have a government that mandates what kind of car you're going to drive. But more importantly, it's about freedom. And we cannot compromise on freedom. Now we have found out the government can mandate insurance. Now we all disagree with that, right? Yes. But why do we disagree? Because we can never compromise on freedom. And just think about it. Just recently, we now have a government that thinks that they can mandate a religious or faith-based institution to compromise on their own faith, to compromise their core beliefs. And why are we against that? Because we all are against that. Why? Because we can never compromise on freedom. Now, you all know me. Most of you all know me. And some people have been critical of me because I don't compromise enough. I didn't compromise when I came out against earmarks and against ethanol and against using taxpayer dollars to fund a baseball stadium and about tariff-free investing and about prohibiting legislators from using taxpayer dollars to their own benefit and about ensuring that we have a transparent government. So you know me, and the reason that I'm the best candidate for this position is because of that. And I would ask each and every one of y'all for your support today, because now we know how close this country is to losing freedom and liberty. And I will never compromise on freedom.
And third, we have John Bruner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Congresswoman Aiken. I'm Congressman Aiken, Treasurer Steelman. It's an incredible privilege to be here. I know you all know a lot about the politicians to the left of me. I want to tell you something about myself. My sense of duty has always called me to serve. You know, I served as a platoon commander in the Marine Corps as an infantry officer, part of 110 Force Ready Reaction Team. I learned a lot of leadership principles in the Marine Corps, and I took those back to the family business where I served as a leader, an entrepreneur, and a small business person. I got behind the forklift trucks and loaded the trucks, helped build the factory, did whatever it took to get the company going. And then I put on a coat and tie, make a sales call, and come back and do it again. We had about 40 associates, and we were able to grow to over 1,400 associates. I also served as a leader in my church, very involved in missions. And I've had a privilege to be over in Zimbabwe, over in Manila, Grenada, many places around the world. It's part of my faith in action. I'm running for the U.S. Senate because, frankly, far too many politicians have failed us. They're protecting their own jobs, their own careers, instead of the ones they were elected to protect. Freedom is stuck in reverse. Horrible debt situation, uncontrollable spending, and red tape regulations that are choking our economy. Missouri needs this new kind of senator, a citizen senator, someone who has demonstrated leadership in building manufacturing business, someone who has proven leadership in terms of pulling teams together and getting them going the right direction, and someone who has demonstrated courage to be able to do the tough decisions, and many times alone. As your citizen senator, I will fight for new independence, a financial independence, one, to get a balanced budget amendment and fair, flatter taxes, two, for energy independence, develop American oil, shale, coal, natural gas, these things to make America independent and renew our energy and our industries, and three, manufacturing and agricultural independence. We got to eliminate the death taxes. We have to get reform. We also have to get regulatory relief. We've got to get America growing again. As your citizen senator, I will fight to restore our republic. I will fight to defend the Constitution. I will protect and defend the sanctity of life. And I will promote free enterprise, small government, and individual responsibility. In working together, we the people can begin to rebuild America and rebuild the American dream. Again, it is a privilege to be here, and I welcome this opportunity to talk with each of you and hopefully on the campaign trail to come. Thank you.
Y'all ready for questions? We'll ask the question, same question to each one of you all, and I'm going to start with John Bruner. And the first question is, in spite of the fact that our unemployment picture looks a wee bit brighter in the last couple of months, what I think we can all agree that the creation of more jobs and is foremost in the minds of most Americans. What specific policies would you propose in the United States Senate to create a more job-friendly environment in this country?
You're exactly right. Jobs are the number one issue, and people are struggling and hurting. I've had the privilege to go across the state a dozen times already to each of the four corners of the state. And what I have found across the board, the number one issue, and it's very similar in my own business, is the regulations, the incessant blizzard of regulations that are coming down and crushing us. I mean, a lot of these folks are just hanging on by their fingernails. Small businesses, small farmers, they don't know what's coming next. We're told yesterday that over 10 new regulations coming out every single day. And, you know, and already in a depressed economy, you're trying to figure out what to do. And regrettably, some people are thinking, it's time to cash it all in. I don't know what's coming tomorrow. The uncertainty, it's incredible. We have to have certainty. And business and agriculture, by definition, has a certain amount of uncertainty to it. But not when a federal government comes in to stir up the pot and create absolute chaos for people that are struggling. You know, Americans love to win. They love to compete. They love to grow. And I know in my own business, I was a sense of pride every time I could hire a new associate and continue to grow the business. And every time I saw someone with a new pickup truck in the yard, in the parking lot, I knew that that person had confidence of another 35 payments. And, well, now maybe it's 59 payments. But in any case, this is what is great. Just get government out of the way, get the regulations off our back, and America can get going again. Number one, stop the regulations, roll back the red tape, and let America start working.
Thank you. Y'all, we have to ask that you not, please, I know you want to, and it kind of makes it more fun, but we're going to try to keep quiet after each of the answers so we can get through more, because we've got a ton of questions here, and I don't want to run out of time, so thank you. Mr. Akin.
Yeah, the people say that the number one thing is jobs. Perhaps that misses a point, and that is you don't have jobs if you declare war on employers, and that's essentially what's gone on. Now, if you wanted to destroy jobs, what would you do? Just playing like you are the devil, and we have one pretty close to that. And so what would you do? The first thing is you tax them a whole lot. Well, that's what we've been doing, taxing them a whole lot. What's the next thing you do? Bury them in red tape. In fact, as John has suggested, I think that in the last maybe year or two, the tax is not quite as bad now as the red tape is. And then, of course, you create an atmosphere of uncertainty, so people don't know what's going to happen next. You spend ourselves into oblivion with absolutely no budget for over 1,000 days, so people say, I'm not really sure whether I want to make an investment, this, that, or the other thing. And then, on top of that, you may mess with the liquidity in the banks by putting regulators in all the banks. And last of all, just spend money like mad, like there's no tomorrow. We're doing all five things guaranteed to destroy jobs. But don't kid yourself, it's not just jobs, you're destroying the employers. In fact, we have actually declared war on certain types of businesses. Obama said he's, for instance, going to shut the coal industry down. Now, it happens that America's reserves of coal make us like the Middle East, only of coal. So what's he doing? He has all these regulations that he's putting in, like enlarging the Streams Act and different things like this that make it impossible for those businesses to survive. Literally, there is a war on business, and the job loss is a fallout on that war. We need to replace the leadership in the White House and replace the leadership in the Senate and take back America.
Sorry, y'all. Sarah Steelman.
Yeah, well, there's no question that Obama and Claire McCaskill and their economic policies have completely failed this country. And we can name off all of the things, the debt and their class warfare and tax increases and their regulatory issues and all of those that are affecting the creation of jobs in this economy. We got to get government out of the way. And actually, yesterday, I announced what I would do for my first 60 days in office, because I have a plan of action to do what we're talking about, which is to get economic growth going again and get job creation going again. And I think the way we do that first is to address the budget. So I believe in a balanced budget and capping the size of government. I think we need to explode the tax system because it's terribly broken in this country. And I think we need to move toward a fairer, flatter tax where we close the loopholes and the special deductions that Washington loves, and we lower the rate as low as we can get it. And I also think we need a sound monetary policy from the Federal Reserve. And one of the things that we need to start with is to make sure that we're auditing them and watching every penny that they're spending, where it's going, where they're loaning it. We need to repeal Obamacare, because Obamacare is causing so much uncertainty to small businesses in this economy everywhere I go. They say that. You know, they're more likely to not expand their businesses because they don't want to go over 50 employees. And we need, and what I'm proposing, is a moratorium on all rules and regulations in this country until Congress can look at each and every one of them and see if they're worth keeping. And that's what I'm going to do in the first 60 days of office. I can only control myself, so I hope I can get my other colleagues to go along with me as well. Thank you.
Watch it. I'll sick Joe Congressman Emerson on you again. So, we also know a very important issue facing us is the Obamacare issue. Now, if Obamacare is struck down or repealed, as we're all hoping that it is, what proposals would you make as far as health care reform and any changes to Medicare and Medicaid programs that you would propose?
Good. We can solve this in 2 minutes. This is going to be great. Look, here's what you got to do. First of all, Obamacare must go. You all know that. That's taken for granted, okay? And you've just seen what that's like. So what do we do? First of all, let's talk about Medicare.
We're doing one of the dumbest things all through history that has never worked, and that's the idea of the government setting prices. They tried to do that in the 1600s back in England, and the whole country was in a disaster. So what do we do in Medicare? We set the price of everything. Let's get rid of all that price-setting stuff, okay? Let's just let the people who get the Medicare dollars shop for the health care they want, probably through an insurance company. But then you have a basically a market kind of principle, and the doctors and hospitals figure out what it costs. There's a competition, and people can take their money and actually, so we get rid of all of the price setting. So that's the first thing. First, get rid of Obamacare. Second of all, the way to attack Medicare is to get rid of the government price setting and use the Medicare dollars so that people actually have purchasing power, can make choices. When we move in that direction, we're moving back toward the free marketplaces. You'll see the cost of health care come down. People will be making the various decisions, and that's a very good start. So accomplishing that is not a small thing. That was part of the Ryan budget last year. And it's going to be part of the Ryan budget because I'm on the budget committee. And we're going to be doing that again, proposing the same idea. So that's your simplest thing. You got to take steps to get us back to a free market in health care. Obviously, there's some other things you can do. Portability of health care across state lines. You want to set up savings accounts, medical savings accounts. That's another piece of the puzzle. And you also want transportability. So if you have a health insurance policy and you move to one company to another, you can take it with you. Thanks.
Me? Okay. Well, first of all, we need to repeal Obamacare. Repeal it and start all over again. But we have to acknowledge that there is a health care problem in this country because the cost of paying for insurance keeps going up and up and up, and it takes more and more of families' discretionary income, and it's hard to get by. It's hard to make ends meet. So we as Republicans do need to do something to replace it, and I think we need to move back to a market-based system where you actually have use price as a mechanism so that people know what you're purchasing before you purchase. I think a perfect example of some of the things that we need to do along those lines is with the ability to buy insurance across state lines. Think about it. You can turn on the TV and you can look at car insurance ads. Geico comes to mind if you've ever seen that. You know how competitive car insurance is. Why can't we make health insurance that competitive, where you really can have downward pressure on prices and more choices for consumers? And it needs to be patient-oriented and not third-party-oriented, where the cost is just being borne by somebody else. You threw a lot of stuff into that question. I think you had Medicaid in there. I believe that we need to, as in the Ryan Plan, block grant Medicaid back to the states. Let the states administer it. I know that there are cost efficiencies that can be found in that, and it's more effective to do at the state level. You can save billions and billions of dollars by doing that. These are things I think we need to deal with right away. Actually, the insurance component is part of my 60-day plan where we start addressing those issues right away. Got the red flag. Red card, I guess, is like in soccer.
Mr. Bremer.
Thank you. Obamacare. Now, we need to call it by its real name because Claire McCaskill was the deciding vote for this program. So I've termed this program the Obama-Claire program, and I think we just need to call it the Obama-Claire program and go forward with that and keep those two together and repeal both of those folks. Anyway, number one, it's freedom to choose. In my business, in a highly competitive business in personal care, private label products, we competed on the third decimal point. And it's amazing, when there's freedom to choose and competition, you get lower prices and better quality. That's what's made the American dream, and that's where the value has come back to the consumers. Far too many politicians have never been in the free enterprise market and don't understand that. But there's another component that comes into play, because we keep talking about this every single election. And herein, we've got to solve the problem. And it comes down to leadership, the courage and guts to deal with the program. Now, in this Republican company, and I hate to mention the name of a liberal Democrat, but it took Ron Wyden of Oregon, a very liberal Democrat, to team up with Paul Ryan and put together and begin to bring some choice into the program, alternatives into the program, but most importantly, leadership on both sides, one in the Senate and one in the House. And this is the kind of work that needs to be done. And Ron Wyden got vilified by his party for actually trying to come up with a solution. We need more citizen senators in Washington, D.C., who have the courage to deal with these problems and, yes, break down the barriers between the states, the block grants, portable insurance accounts. Bottom line, bring freedom back into the decision process, and we'll get this program turned around very fast.
Thank you all so much. First question goes to Sarah Steelman. The number one industry in the state of Missouri is agriculture, and I realize that unless you live in outstate Missouri, you don't sometimes realize that. We are so rich and diverse from corn and soybeans to cotton and rice, and we're one of the very top producing livestock states in the country. Well, every 5 years, the Congress is set to reauthorize farm programs, and the farm bill is up this year. It's probable that it'll get pushed back to next year when one of you all will be in the United States Senate. So for our producers here in Missouri, what would be your guiding principles? What policies would you promote in the next farm bill?
Well, you're right about agriculture. It is the most important industry to Missouri and frankly, to the country. And oftentimes, it's taken for granted by a lot of people. And in fact, I'm from Rolla, and we have a saying down there that if it can't be grown, it has to be mined. So those two things are important, as you probably know, Joanne. And then with respect to some of the policies that I think we need to pursue, the one thing that I hear from farmers and ranchers all over Missouri is a complaint about the assault on their property rights. And it comes from every single level of government, frankly. You've got the EPA, you've got the Corps of Engineers, you have U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, you have DNR at the state level and Department of Conservation, and, you know, it's just sometimes you have to deal with seven agencies just to get any kind of permit to allow you to move gravel, even on your own farmland. So I think, and farmers tell me this, that the most important thing that they deal with and the most frustrating thing that they deal with is this issue, because people don't understand that landowners and farmers and ranchers know how to take care of their own land without the federal government coming in and trying to second-guess everything that they're going to do, every mistake they might make, trying to make a one-size-fits-all to meet their different types of activity. It's absolutely ridiculous, and it has to stop, and it will stop if we can take back the United States Senate and get conservatives who will actually stand up to these regulatory agencies, start defunding them, cutting them, undoing the regulations.
Thank you. John Bruner.
Thank you. You know, the core of my platform are two areas here. I talked about a new independence, both in manufacturing and in agriculture. And we've seen what's happened with manufacturing, and we cannot let it happen to agriculture. I mean, it is despicable what the federal government is doing. Again, I'm going back to harping on those issues of regulation and on incessant regulations that they're trying to deal with. We all know the situation with the dust on the farms, and, of course, Claire McCaskill comes in like to rescue the situation by putting a temporary suspension on legislation that she supported. They don't need temporary suspension. They need the removal of this legislation. And then we also have the Department of Labor now coming in. I mean, for the kids to be able to work on the farm, to go to their grandfather's farm or their neighbor's farm, and now the Department of Labor wants to determine, well, what's the temperature in the silo and on how many steps on a ladder they can climb. I mean, what do they expect these kids to do, go into town and work at McDonald's? It is an incredible attack on our agriculture. We got to get the federal government out of the way so we can start working again. But we do have some positive opportunities and really an opening of the trade. You know, we're the breadbasket to the world. And our government, on the other hand, has delayed and held back opportunities for our farmers to export their products around the world. Now, a couple have opened up recently, but we need to open up our export opportunities and break down those trade barriers on our exports. So we have some great opportunities there. And finally, and I have to go back because the federal government just bugs the heck out of me. I was up in northwestern Missouri and met a fourth-generation farmer. And when they flooded his property up there, he said, you know, I will never be able to farm again in my lifetime. And I thought if I was a U.S. senator, I'd just prop my desk right there, put the American flag and Missouri flag on either side and say, come, bring on the water. We need people who are advocates and will fight for agriculture in Missouri. And I plan to be that fighter.
Thank you. Todd Akin.
Well, first thing, having been there, I've been consistently rated friend of the Farm Bureau because I do care about agriculture, and it is extremely important. Now, a couple of the other different issues. One is there's a continuous attack on farmers' right to land with the increasing size of the streams and some little ditch somewhere that gets wet a couple of times if it's raining hard. And so those kinds of attacks that have been increasing, particularly in the last couple of years, have got to stop. The idea of telling somebody, obviously somebody who wrote the stuff has never seen a field or a farm, that you can't have rogue dust, that is the dust that comes off the corn that you're harvesting, blowing to the neighbor's farm. I mean, this is just absolutely bizarre. And there are, of course, a whole series of things in the red tape area. I think one that strikes me as the most irritating are the family farms where the kids are being told they have to work only a certain number of days or whatever. You know, hard work is something America could learn as a very good virtue for our young people, and to try to mess with that is really destructive to our country. Now, Joanne really made the question about the Farm Bill, and, of course, that's a little trickier political question. But let me just say a couple of things. One, I would try to phase out like direct payments where the government is doing actually sort of bailout-y types of things over a period of time. But also, I would like to disconnect the Farm Bill because of the fact that we could create some non-government but price stability in the market so that we don't have 70% of the Farm Bill is a bunch of welfare payments. You know, what the trouble is in this country to some degree is we overtax the people who work and overpay the people who don't work. And that is connected with the Farm Bill. That should be disconnected. Thank you.
Thank you. The primary purpose of the federal government, as stated in the Constitution, is to provide for the common defense. It's the first thing. Now, obviously, that's a very important national policy. We have disagreements with the Obama administration on exactly national defense, national security issues. Can you specifically describe areas where you agree and disagree with the Obama administration concerning national defense? We'll start with Mr. Bruner.
Well, first of all, the budget that was proposed is atrocious that they came out increasing welfare and increasing foreign aid and cutting defense. Now, I guess this president feels a lot better about Hillary Clinton than he does the United States Marine Corps. I have a difference of opinion there. And I tell you, when I was deployed overseas as part of the Ready Reaction Force, we kind of had a joke with my platoon that when the real exigency hits, that we turn in all the stuff that doesn't work, and they'd give us the real good stuff. Now, I know the jokes that come down that, you know, the Army gets rid of their old stuff to the Marine Corps, and we make the best use of it. But folks, it's really, really serious here. And we have lost our edge. China has developed a submarine force that is quieter, faster than our own. And it takes years to get into the pipeline, the R&D, and the development for the technology. As a former Marine, national defense is absolutely critical. And we need to be putting our resources back into developing the latest technology and the latest weaponry. We knew what President Reagan was able to do on initiating the Star Wars and pushing the Soviet Union back. He operated from a position of strength, and we have to embrace that. Too few people in Washington, D.C., and elected officials have even served in the military. So we have a real challenge here. Our troops have made many, many deployments. We're scattered all over the world. We got to realign our priorities, take care of our military, invest in R&D, and get our national defense strong again.
Congressman Aiken.
Yeah, thank you. I'm on the Armed Services Committee, so this is getting up close and personal. And what you have essentially is, part of your question was, isn't there something we could agree with in Obama? I think that part is no. I don't think there is. Let's just take a look at where his priorities are. He's increased food stamps by 68% and slashing defense by 20%. We're just talking about now the effect of the first 10% cuts, and the second 10% cuts are so draconian that the Defense Department is being told by their leadership, don't even think about what this means. The head of all of the military was asked, this 10% cut that's been talked about now called sequestration, is that like shooting yourself in the foot? He said, no, it's like shooting yourself in the head. The environment from a threat point of view is more dangerous than ever. You've got Iran developing nuclear weapons. You've got China with increasing threats to us on a number of fronts. Their ballistic missile threat to our carriers and other ships. You've got the submarine threat and some other things that are somewhat classified in terms of what they're doing. So defense is a place where we just don't have anything at all in common with Obama. And I'll tell you, if we don't stop this second 10% cut, right now, America has the number of surface ships that we had in 1917. Think about that, 1917. That's where our surface ships are. And Obama, if you take this next 10% cut, we are talking about an extremely insecure America. We're going to think about doing things in the military. We can't do it. Sorry, we can't do it. Thank you.
Well, I would agree with Congressman Aiken that I don't agree on anything that President Obama has done with regard to defense. In his latest proposal, he cut the number of troops. And no, I don't agree with that. He does not have, he has not earned the respect around the world that is needed in order to conduct foreign policy. But I think one of the biggest threats to our own defense, our own strong national defense that we must have, that I believe we must have and invest in, is the fact that we have a $15 trillion national debt. And why is that important to our national defense? Because it's like a supply line. And, in the military, when you cut your enemy's supply line, you get them. So our supply line is now in jeopardy in this country, $15 trillion. We need to fix the financial problem we have in this country so that we can be sure that we have a strong economy and that we have money to put into a strong national defense. I have said that we need to cut government, and I believe everything needs to be on the table. And I know it may not be popular to say that defense needs to be on the table too, but I'm going to say it because I think there's waste in defense spending. Now, do I think we should jeopardize any soldier in the field? Absolutely not. We got to make sure that our dollars are being used wisely and protecting our soldiers and going into troops in the military and assets that will be sure and protect our country. But we also can cut some of the waste.
Thank you all. We see very, very challenging times in the Middle East right now. Whether it's Iran or Syria, Egypt, Tunisia, you name it, all of which has an impact both directly and indirectly on the United States. Specifically, though, in Egypt, after the fall of the government and the democratic forces, if you will, coming into power, some of our relationships have changed. And right now we have several Americans working with the International Republican Institute, a democracy building group, who have been put into safekeeping of the embassy and who will be brought to trial. in light of this, and you can probably apply this to other countries with whom we do business in the Middle East, do you believe we should rethink the foreign aid that we provide to countries like Egypt? Todd Akin.
Yeah, that's an easy one. Yeah, sure should.
And explain how.
Yeah, right. You know, what you've got, all of those Middle Eastern countries, almost all of them, are pretty darn turbulent, with the exception of Israel. And that turbulence, particularly in all of these uprisings, many of these governments are becoming much more hardline Muslim extremist types. And I think that I'd be very cautious about just, for instance, ignoring the Congress and taking us to war with Libya, which the president was quite comfortable. Of course, he doesn't care much about the Constitution anyway. But I would be very cautious about us jumping into some of these different wars and situations. However, if we have U.S. citizens that are in danger, I believe we should respond the way Ronald Reagan did in Grenada. And as we go in there and we hit them fast and we get our people free and we move out. And in just the same way we took out bin Laden, I wouldn't be ashamed to do those kinds of things. But I would be very careful about getting us involved. The founders were very cautious about getting into entangling alliances or particularly long and sort of ill-defined conflicts. And so that would be an area that I'd stay clear of. But other than that, when it comes to specifically protecting our citizens or taking decisive action, particularly against a nuclear threat, then I say we act decisively, quickly, and finally.
Let me ask a follow-up to that, which is not part of the program, specifically with regard to foreign aid, because we do provide foreign aid to Egypt and Pakistan and a lot of the countries in the Middle East. And my question was specifically, do we rethink the foreign aid that we provide to those countries?
Well, I think we should rethink it, and I think that that should always be on the table every year. And I'm not very comfortable with the whole idea of the foreign aid in the first place. I understand that it gives us a little bit of leverage and try to keep some peace and stability, but at the same time, I think it's a little bit of an iffy question that you can say that the Constitution says that our taxpayers should be paying to give money to other people. I don't like it at all, and particularly in countries like Egypt that have changed and say, don't give them any money.
Thank you, sir.
You know, it's symbolic of Washington to talk about whether we have to rethink spending each year, because, you know, every year we're only dealing with the increase and not ever getting down into the core budget to begin with. Yes, I do think we need to rethink foreign aid to those countries all over the world, and I think we do need to have strings attached. But more importantly, I think, again, that we have to deal with our own fiscal crisis in this country and figure it out. Right now, all we do, or all Washington does, is put Band-Aids on things. They don't really get dig down and try to fix what's wrong with our economy. I'll say it again. We have a $15 trillion national debt in this country. We're almost at 100% of GDP on a debt-to-GDP ratio. Greece is at 160%. We've got a problem, and foreign aid is important, but I want to make sure that there are strings attached to those dollars if we send them. I know the Middle East is in a turmoil, and we are faced with the unknown threat of radical Islamist extremists. The Muslim Brotherhood now has a substantial hold in Egypt. So we need to be careful about what we do and what kind of relationship and what kind of financial relationship we have with those countries. So my answer to that is yes, I think we need to rethink all spending in this country from the bottom up, including foreign aid.
Thank you. John?
Yes. Your question on foreign aid comes right to the crux of a lack of any focused foreign policy. It seems like they wake up every morning and figure out what they're going to do. You know, I had a privilege this week to meet with some incredible, great leaders in the U.S. Senate, Jim DeMint and Tom Coburn. But I had a great discussion with Senator Rand Paul, and he's pushing an initiative right now through the Senate to cut all foreign aid to Egypt in order to free those that are being held. Now, that is common sense to me, and that's the kind of leadership you need in the U.S. Senate. You go back 4,000 years ago, and someone said, let my people go and get us out of Egypt. That is the kind of focus we need to do. We're not going to continue to send you billions of dollars while you hold American citizens hostage. And you move that into the next area here in terms of how we're treating Israel. Israel is our friend, but we send more foreign aid to Israel's enemies than we do to Israel. What kind of policy is that? And I also have to comment on our former chairman of Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mike Mullen, when he said, our greatest risk to our national security is our debt. Now, he didn't say terrorism. He said the greatest risk to our national security is our debt. So what are we doing giving money to countries that are harming Americans, that are greatly at risk, where our own country needs the money to rebuild our own roads, our own infrastructures, and take care of our own people and rebuild our military? So, yes, we needed a very solid, aggressive, clear strategy that we will not send foreign aid to people who injure and harm and capture and hold Americans.
Thank you. You know, the United States of America is a nation that's built of immigrants. We have certainly proud of that tradition. We see states such as Arizona and Alabama who are taking it in their own hands to crack down on illegal immigration, I think basically out of a frustration with the lack of a federal solution in the federal government dropping the ball on illegal immigration. How would you balance the history and the legacy of this country being a nation of immigrants with the lack of an immigration policy? What would be an appropriate policy on immigration that would enable us to secure our borders and continue the legacy that this country is built on? Sarah.
Well, you're right, David. We are a nation that is built on immigration, and we're proud of it. We're proud of it because we are knitted together with all kinds of different backgrounds and ethnicities and cultures, and we want to make sure that we remain American, though. And that's important. I mean, I think part of the immigration problem is speeding up legal immigration in this country. I mean, right now it takes almost 7 years to become to come into the country legally. So that's one thing we need to do. And then on the other side, of course, we have to secure our borders, and we have to take away the incentives that exist today that are encouraging illegal immigration in this country. And that includes employers that hire illegal workers. We need to do something about that. We need to crack down on those employers and take away that incentive. We need to take away any benefits that illegals have access to right now in this country. We have it in reverse. We have a role that the federal government is supposed to be playing in securing our borders and making sure that we have only legal immigration in this country, and the federal government does nothing about it. You know, I've had experience in the state treasurer's office, believe it or not, where I had to deal with a company that hired illegal workers and was getting state tax credits for it. And I couldn't get the federal government to do anything about it. These guys were arrested on site. I had their arrest records. They stated to the police that they were illegal, and still the federal government did nothing. So I changed the policies that were used to allocate tax credits to make sure that workers didn't, or that developers did not, or were penalized for hiring illegals and on their job.
Thank you, John.
Yes. You know, Mr. Chairman, we have a wonderful legacy of immigrants. You know, our motto here is out of many, one, a melting pot with different generations from different countries all coming together with a common goal called the American Dream. And, you know, we have a problem because we have rules and regulations that are in place to support legal immigration, and we're doing nothing or very little with illegal immigration. In fact, I'd go so far to support the rights of those citizens down in Texas and Arizona that if the federal government fails to protect the borders, they have a right to step in there and protect their borders. I mean, in this particular age where we have all of these regulations at our airports and the TSA and when we go through immigration and what we have a sieve on our southern border, our former board member of our company lives down there in Sierra Vista, just a few miles from the border, and he tells about stuff left in his front yard and backyard as the immigrants are rushing through. Now, he says it's a good thing to live close to the border because they keep running north as opposed to being further north. But this is a serious problem. And we don't have an administration with the guts to defend our borders. You know, I had a situation in our company, a wonderful individual, a plant manager. He was from Kenya. And he was going to do all the right things. And he was doing a great job in the company. But he was trying to process the immigration papers and get everything done correctly. And then he married a young lady from the UK. And he says, John, if I can't get this going, I'm going to have to leave the company. And I did everything I could. And he finally had to quit and move to Canada and go back because of the tremendous regulation. We need to support legal immigration, and we need to defend and stop illegal immigration.
Congressman Aiken.
Yeah, there's a principle here, and things we ought to look at things from a principle point of view, and that is we're talking about we're a nation of law. We have laws on the books, and the reason we have laws on the books is to enforce the laws that are on the books, and we're not really doing that. So, first of all, you don't really have to create more laws because the laws are there. It's just the federal government is refusing to do anything about them. So that's a simple thing. We basically enforce the law. Now, another thing that could be done, I think, that would help a whole lot in a couple of different areas, and that is if you're going to get a job with an employer, you're supposed to run your name through the database of a real ID so that you could, as an employer, you know you're hiring somebody that's a legal person for you to hire. Well, we could extend that. Why don't we extend that and say that people who are getting services in America, all kinds of different services, have to have their ID run through just to make sure that they're legitimately here. So that's a piece of it. We voted on a bill, and people thought we were barbarians as conservatives because what we said was after somebody's treated at a hospital, if they're not a legitimate, if they're an illegal immigrant, then we send them back after they get out of the hospital. Oh, that you thought that was a crisis just to enforce our laws. And then you've got instead the government's fiddling around with silly things like Fast and Furious trying to entrap people who were gun people instead of actually working in the border. I've been down to Texas and taken a look at the situation, and one thing that I haven't heard people talk about, but this is a sort of a federalism principle, that little ribbon of land, which is the border, is federally patrolled, supposedly. But I'll tell you, your local law enforcement can do an awful lot to fix this up if we just allow the local law enforcement to do the law. Thank you.
Sarah mentioned in one of her answers this debt situation with Greece. And because we live in such a globalized economy now, and we all are interconnected, if you will, what matters in other places may or may not impact us, particularly in the Eurozone. I would like your thoughts, John, and Todd and Sarah, on whether or not the United States should, if asked, should help stabilize the Eurozone economy.
You know, this is, you're exactly right. We have an economic situation that knows no borders, and that what affects us in one part of the world travels very fast to the rest of the part of the world. From a positive standpoint, that has to do as well with investment. Where can you make the best investment? But then you have problems that are very, very serious throughout the world. I have a very good friend in Greece. He's a brilliant investor and economist, and I have a chance to stay in communication with him as well. And he says, John, what you see here in the streets of Athens is going to be coming across the rest of this world. It's a powder keg that's simmering, and we got to be very, very careful about how the United States government engages in terms of the actions to stabilize the economies of the world. But the real missing ingredient and why we don't know what we're doing and why we don't know what we can do all goes to the basis of our Federal Reserve System. And we have a system here, a private bank with quasi-federal elements to it, that continues to send out hundreds of billions and trillions of dollars to countries that we're not even aware of. So here, our own country, our U.S. Congress, our Senate, our President has no idea what this independent organization is doing and the possible impacts that it could make around the world. So we have to get to the point where we know that one of the greatest impacts into the world's economy happens to be something that we have no understanding or idea of what's going on. And so that starts with auditing the Fed. Freedom of Information Act has already shown us what some of these elements are, but we have to get that under control. At the end of the day, we got to take care of America first and be sure our country's in good shape before we take all of our money and give it to some of these other countries.
Thank you, Todd.
Boy, this is an easy one to do in a short period of time. You know, the answer is no, no more bailouts. We don't need any bailouts in this country, and we certainly don't need to be bailing out the euro. We're already in debt up to our ears, and for us to be having anything to do with the euro, I think is just crazy for us to do it. In fact, the whole concept of the euro, I think, is kind of questionable because you have all these different countries over there, and some of them, like Greece, decide they're going to politicians allow the pensions to go up and up and up, and pretty soon it bankrupts the country. And then what's supposed to happen? France and Germany are supposed to jump in? This is crazy. And for us to be putting money over there, that's nuts to do it. And John's right about auditing the Fed. I'm on that bill. I've been on the bill for a couple of years. It's a Ron Paul bill. It's his best bill, in my opinion. We ought to audit the Fed. In fact, the Congress has abdicated a lot of its authority in terms of money supply. I would go farther than auditing the Fed. I'd say we ought to stabilize the currency. The best thing we can do for this world is not bail out things that are failing, but it's rather to make sure that our own economic situation is strong, so there's some stability to the world economy. We are a major part of the world economy. When we fail in our economic responsibilities, they say America catches a cold and the world catches pneumonia. That's really true for some of these small countries. So we really want to do the thing right. We need to get back and pay attention to our own economy and stop fiddling around with the concept of bailouts. And I do think we should audit the Fed and stabilize the dollar.
Sarah.
Well, I think that the Eurozone has been a complete disaster. And I think we're seeing what has happened to it when you have that many countries come together with different work ethics, different cultures. You know, now we've got Germany, those countries looking to Germany to bail them out, where Germany had a very productive and good economy. You know, Margaret Thatcher didn't get into the Eurozone. She made that decision. She caught a lot of flack for that, but that was a smart thing to do. And no, I do not think the United States should be bailing out the euro. I think what we're going to find out, though, is that there's a lot of debt that American banks are carrying that it's going to be affected by the euro. And I, like Congressman Nakin, I do not think we should be bailing out banks. I did not believe in TARP and the bailout. We have ourselves in a financial mess to begin with. Washington isn't dealing, again, with the financial crisis that is facing our country. And it's like they can't see the writing on the wall. Greece is a mess. 160% of GDP, debt to GDP ratio. 160%. We're at 100%. We had been downgraded, and Congress ignored it. They didn't do anything about it. We keep going down the same path, missing all the warning signs. And we're in trouble in this country, and we need to spend some time looking at our own national debt. How are we going to get rid of it? How are we going to get growth going in this economy again? And how are we going to reduce spending? And those are the things we need to be dealing with. Europe is going to have to take care of itself until we get control of our own financial destiny.
You know, we there are certain things that we all know are given. We're given that we have too much debt, we don't have enough money. Another given is that our roads and bridges and infrastructure and transportation systems in this country need work. They need repair. They need fixing. How would you address that the conundrum of those two juxtaposed against each other? You know, we have roads that are and bridges that are crumbling, some of them well over 100 years old, versus the fact that we don't have any money to fix those things. Would you, how would you propose to do that, and would that include any revenue, say a gas tax increase or something like that, to pay for transportation and infrastructure issues? Todd.
Yeah, thank you. First off, I have always fought against gas tax increases at the federal level. Part of the reason is because we don't get any, when we send a dollar there, it comes back in a smaller package. And so, first of all, I don't like the idea of increasing gasoline taxes at the federal level. Second of all, how do you fund infrastructure? I'm very much supportive of that. And in places where it's been possible, I have directed money to rebuild and taken a lead in rebuilding infrastructure that's critical in our state, such as Highway 44 and Highway 40 and some other different roads, and as well as some things on rivers. So I think that that's something that's a legitimate function of federal government. I've taken the lead to try to make sure that that money goes to legitimate things. Now, one of the things that Missouri did that was smart, and that was to say 100% of the money that's collected in gas taxes goes to roads and bridges. And this is the basic principle here. What you really want is you want a user tax. Now, what we can do is, if we direct the full amount of money that comes in gasoline taxes at the federal level, if all of that goes to roads and bridges, then you're going to have an increased amount of money to spend, which would help some. Before I would look at any kind of gasoline tax increase, I think we do better to copy what the governor of Indiana did, and that is to simply put some toll booths on, say, Highway 70, because when you do that, it's a user fee. If you don't use it, you don't pay the fee. And they were able to do that in spite of all this public criticism. They were able to do that, and they raised enough money there to cover all of the needs for roads and bridges in their state. So I don't like tax increases, but a user fee, for instance, like a toll on a road, would be my escape hatch in terms of trying to get that funds. Thanks.
Sarah?
I do not support any tax increases, period. I think the American people are taxed too much as it is. And the other thing is that the funding on public infrastructure should be a priority. It's not that we don't have any money. We've got plenty of money. The federal government is not spending it on the right things. You know, when you are spending it to make a dependent class in this country, we can change a lot of our priorities and have money to spend on infrastructure, as long as it's fairly spent and on good federal, good public projects that need help. I think we need to be looking at reprioritizing all of our spending. And the way I think to do that is, I believe in zero-based budgeting, where we go in and instead of, as Washington does, deal with the decreasing the increase each year, which they aren't even doing that, but forget that. We need to go into each program in the federal government and look at it and find out what it's about. Is it constitutional? If it is, do we really need it? If we really need it, should it be at the federal level, the state level, or the local level? In my opinion, we should push everything as close to the people as we can possibly get, and we will gain efficiencies and effectiveness by doing that. And we will prioritize our spending by doing that, and we need to do it every year. Congress isn't doing their job. Let's face it, they're not doing their job. We need to get in and look at where our dollars are being spent, and I would do that.
John.
Thank you. You know, this comes back to foreign aid. And why are we building roads and infrastructure in some of these war zones when our own roads and infrastructures are suffering? A inverse of priorities, getting back to America first. We need people to think what needs to be done here first in our own country. You know, whether it's block grants to the states or there's been initiatives in terms of this federal gas tax. Why do we have a federal gas tax? Why is the money going to Washington, D.C., and then coming back in the forms of earmarks and political decisions in terms of what really needs to be fixed in different parts of the state? We've got to get the politics, especially the federal government, out of this. And these, I would rescind the federal gas tax and let that be a part of a state usage gas tax, because the states and the individual communities know better than the federal government and better than elected officials carving out special, like I said, earmarks for different areas in terms of infrastructure. We have an inverse of priorities. You know, finally, I would say, and this goes down to common sense, that the best decisions seem to be always made closer to the action. The best decisions for our road and infrastructures in our different small towns and communities don't happen from Washington, D.C., but let's move that to Jefferson City and let them move it down to our other communities. I've had personal experience with many years in manufacturing and business where there's a tendency to get those decisions made from the top. And I remember one time we were ordering a brand new production line, and all the engineers decided this is what we need. And I said, well, have you talked to the mechanics on the production line, what they need? Oh, no, they'll really like it. Well, send it down there. Well, these guys on the line said, you know, they're ordering some of the wrong filling tubes. A few changes here can really save us a lot of money. And that same piece of equipment is still running today 15 years later, all because you decentralized decision-making. That's what we need to do.
All right, y'all. I think we'll try to end on a high note. So, Todd, you're going to get this question first. Could you please tell us something or some things that are nice about your two opponents?
Well, thank you. Just on that, I'm going to loop back because there's no rebuttals, but you can add a little add-on. And that is, I like the idea of reducing the federal gasoline tax, but to a certain degree, there is a federal function in the roads, because if you've got Interstate 70 going across Indiana and it hits Illinois and they don't hook up, that's not a good thing. So there is some logic in having some federal designation of where the basic highway routes go. Just a thought on that subject. Now, something nice. Yeah, it's easy to say something nice. I'm going to start with my good friend John Bruner. Hey, you're going to. This is a little bit silly, but you know, I really like John Bruner because John has been a friend of mine. He's always supported me because I'm a fierce conservative, and he also gave me $10,000 to run for Senate. That's a nice thing to say about John Bruner. But I'm kidding a little bit, but John is a super guy and has always been a good patriot. And Sarah also she has served the state in a lot of different ways. I think there's one major thing you said, Sarah, one time that I disagree violently with. It's the only thing almost. And that was, you said that you were objecting because Claire McCaskill took too long a vacation. I think she should take about a 6-year vacation.
Sarah?
Well, I don't know Mr. Bruner well, but I have used his hand sanitizer before. And
you.
I appreciate that very much, but I'm sure I will get to know him better along the trail. And Todd and I have shared some fun moments together. I've really gotten to know him quite well, and appreciate him as a family man and what he believes in, I can't think of anything specific. I don't know any deep, dark secrets of Todd Akin yet, but maybe I'll find some out.
Thank you. John?
Well, thank you very much. First of all, Congressman Akin, I gave you money to run for Congress, and you didn't listen to me. But, that's why, you need to listen to your constituents a little better. I think. And Sarah, thank you so much for that compliment on hand sanitizer. You know, a couple of years ago, we had a special run in the plant. Instead of antibacterial, it was anti-bureaucratic, kills germs from Democrats. And they won't let me do that anymore. But in all seriousness, and I love the question because I have my oldest and my youngest here, my daughter Elizabeth and my son John, and when they were getting to fighting back and forth, I'd get around the table and say, now, say something nice about each other. And things like, well, you don't stink as much anymore, and, your pimples have gone away. Those kind of things came out. But I tell you, in all seriousness, what I really, really admire here by the two people who have served in office and by so many who are state legislators and state senators and who run for county commissioners, you know, this is an incredible challenge, and it's tough. And I've gained tremendous respect for all of those who stepped in, whether it's a school board or a fire district or running for Senate, because we need to get more citizen senators, more citizen legislators, more people from with real experience into office. And so I commend these two, as well as many of you here, who have served this country and served this state so well. And I'm up for the challenge, and I'm going to do my very best.
Thank you. Now we're going to, that's going to conclude our questions. We're going to go on to our closing statements. I think one thing that we all can agree on is that we need to send Claire McCaskill back home. And that's certainly the easiest thing that we can agree on. Again, I want to thank you for joining us today. It's been very, very good, very informative. And we're going to go with our closing. We'll have now 3 minutes to close, and we will start with Todd.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate your having a chance to join the forum here today. And I think that a lot of us know basically some of the stuff we've got to do. As Ronald Reagan said, it's simple, it's just not easy. One of the things, obviously, in the Senate, you need people that are going to put someone on the Supreme Court that actually defends the Constitution. We've seen an administration that has no regard for law or the Constitution. You need to obviously take the common sense of Missouri with a cap on the size of government, index it to the GDP, and also a balanced budget. We do that in Missouri, and our budget works pretty well here. Boy, would that be something if we could get that done in Washington, D.C. That's absolutely necessary. We've talked about repealing Obamacare. We've seen the first specter of what comes from that, which is a total trampling on your First Amendment rights. Wait till they get the power to decide whether or not they're going to give you health care. Then are you going to talk about being a Republican? They're going to control your very life. Do we want the federal government doing that? We voted 71% no. And then we go with these different proposals to take our land away from us. The simple solution on that Agenda 21, get us out of the United Nations. No problem there. Then let's talk about the fact that we've just got an explosion. There's 70 different kinds of welfare programs out there. We tried to reform one of them. The 70 are never collected in one place. And we have got more and more people living on dependency. Now, some people call that compassionate. I believe that God made every single one of us in a special way for a special purpose and not to be fitted with the velvet chains of the welfare state. I think we should be encouraging the welfare state by letting people learn how to work and how to have traditional marriages and to join into the life that God made for them. And then let's and there are quite a number of things like the flat tax kind of thing or changing the tax code. And the red tape is just a mess. We need to literally dismantle bureaucracies in D.C. But all of these things we know that we have to do, and some people would encourage you that if you have enough enthusiasm and you have enough optimism, we can get there. Let me tell you, I've been there, and that's not going to be enough. Now, there is a hopeful side to this, and that is America has faced impossible challenges as we face today before, and there's a certain formula for that. They remember, first of all, the dream that is America. They remember that we are one nation under God with the right to life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness that comes from Him. Each of us has a value and a purpose. We need to remember that dream. We need to be able to put it all on the line. That's everybody here. And then we need the last thing you must do. You have to turn back to God and ask His help. Thank you. Sarah.
Well, I want to thank all of you all for your participation in politics, because I still believe in the strength of the American people, and that's the way we're going to change our nation and our government, is with the people. And, you know, everybody's going to call themselves a conservative. Even Claire McCaskill's trying to call herself a conservative now. With her new radio ad, she says she's against abortion. Yeah, well, we all know that that's not true. But I have had a record as a proven conservative, and I will fight for the people of this state and this country, and I have. And, you know, I learned early on to do that. I got some great advice from my father-in-law, Dorman Steelman, and some of y'all may know him in the audience. He passed away about 3 years ago, but he was a good old Ozark boy, and he grew up down on the Current River. He went to school in a one-room schoolhouse. You know, he's the first of 11 kids to graduate from college. He became a judge. He actually served as chairman of the Republican Party for a couple years and got ousted because he was too conservative even back then. But he had some great advice for me when I went to the State Senate back in 1998 when I ran for the first time. And he said, Sarah, when you get there, you got to stand up and fight for what you believe in. Because what's going to happen to you? On your first hard vote, there's going to be a group of people that come to you. And they're going to say, hey, we really need you to vote with us this time. We really need you to vote with this time. So that you can live to fight another battle, another day. But this time you need to be with us. And those people are the lobbyists. They're the special interests. They're the big contributors. They're members of your own party. Sometimes it's leadership of your own party. And they will come to you time and time again, and they'll ask you to do that. You got to be with us this time so you can live to fight another day. And someday, you wake up and you realize that all those battles that you went to fight have passed you by because you didn't stand up and fight for what you believe in when you could. And ladies and gentlemen, that's what's happened in Washington, D.C. today. People are not standing and fighting for us when they can. And it's going to be too late if we don't get together and change it. And change it with this election. Because it's not, we can look at all the problems we have out there. But if we don't have different people in Washington who are willing to stand up and fight the status quo and fight for what they believe in when they can, we're going to get the same outcome. I'm going to be your fighter. I will always put your interests first. And I appreciate you so much. Thank you all for coming today.
Mr. Bruner.
Thank you. Like my fellow candidates and all of you here today, I love our great country and really believe that the best days are yet ahead. But the Obama administration has put us on a reckless course with a voting support of Claire McCaskill. These two have teamed up together to take us to the brink of disaster. You know, to paraphrase President Reagan, the Obama and McCaskill view of economic stimulus is summed up in a few short phrases. If it moves, tax it. If it keeps moving, regulate it. And if it stops moving, subsidize it. You know, President Obama and Senator McCaskill have trampled out our amber waves of grain, allowing the weeds of despair, greed, and envy to take root. Our first step to recovery and the first step of recovering America as the land of opportunity and to get us back on course is to replace Claire McCaskill and reclaim the majority in the U.S. Senate. Now, the way to defeat Claire McCaskill is to nominate the strongest candidate, a candidate who spent his entire life manufacturing products that were stamped made in the USA and not passing legislation that said mandated by Washington, D.C. A candidate who has a track record of improving jobs and benefits and not a career politician who avoids the hard decisions while raising the debt ceiling. A candidate that will go to fight to repeal Obama-Claire and not worry about the fight for his reelection. A candidate that believes in God we trust isn't just engraved on our coins, but also in our hearts, as together we guide America out of the darkness into dawn's early light. I am that candidate, and I humbly ask for your prayers, your support, and your vote. If nominated, I will defeat Claire McCaskill. I will be that citizen senator that provides leadership for a change. Thank you, and may God continue to shed his grace and mercy on America.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank all three of you. We got three excellent choices here.